From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. On today's program, Gail Samak-Lemon of the Council on Foreign Relations brings us an update on changes in U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. And author and journalist David Marinus takes us back to the heyday of Detroit with a new book. But first, Gloria Steinem has been at the forefront of the feminist movement for decades. At 81, she's still striving to bring down the barriers that have blocked full equality for women. She chronicles those battles and many more aspects of her rich and fascinating life in a new memoir called My Life on the Road. Gloria Steinem joins us now from New York. Ms. Steinem, good to have you on this program.
It's great to be here. If only I were sitting on your couch.
Well, I wish you were. We'll make that happen at some point. When it occurred to me on the occasion of receiving this text that this is the first book, while you've written many before, the first one you've written in 20 years, I started to think of all the things that have transpired in the world over the last two decades that we might have benefited from by reading a book from Gloria Steinem. Why 20 years since the last one?
Well, ironically, it's an on-the-road book, and I was on the road, so I started it 20 years ago, but I would do it every summer when I travel a little less. I do it for a month,
right,
and then not do it for 11 months, and it got to be too long, and I had to have two editor friends come with a machete and take out some of it. I'll put the rest on a website. I mean, you know, activism gives you something you want most in life to write about, and then it takes away the time to write.
Gloria, in this book, My Life on the Road, you say that there are events in our lives that tend to divide our lives into the before and the after. What was that moment specifically for you?
Well, there are many things, but I think the single most important one was when I was being a journalist shortly after we had started New York Magazine, and I knew there was an organization called NOW, but it seemed that it was more for women who were not in the labor force and wanted to get in the labor force. I had been part of various organizations about civil rights and the migrant workers movement and so on, but I went to cover a hearing on abortion that was held in a church basement in downtown New York, because the state legislature had a hearing on whether or not to liberalize their abortion law. This was just before Roe v. Wade. Mm-hmm. And they had invited to testify 14 men and one nun. You can't make this up, right? Mm-hmm. So a group of women had said, wait a minute, let's hear from women who have actually had the experience of searching for a doctor or having an illegal abortion. And they had a hearing. And I sat there as a reporter, listening to women tell the truth in public about something they were not supposed to tell the truth about for the first time in my life. And I had had an abortion earlier when I first graduated from college. It gave me my life. I mean, I wouldn't have been able to live my life otherwise. But yet I had never spoken about it. So to me, that was the beginning of a great unraveling. You know, once you begin to pull at the string of injustice, the whole ball of, you know, globe of injustice begins to unravel. Mm.
Which raises, I think, the obvious question as a follow-up, what you make all these years later than what many regard as an attack on Planned Parenthood.
You know, Planned Parenthood is one of, and maybe by some measures, the single most popular, supported organization in the country, because it has helped so many people. So something like one in five, you know, it's huge. And the attack on it is, you know, only about 1% of what they do has anything to do with abortion. But it is part of an ultra-right-wing attempt to restore the basis of patriarchy or a male dominant system and the necessity of a long-term racist system, which is controlling reproduction. And to control reproduction, you have to control the bodies of women. Women now are doing nothing less than seizing control of the means of reproduction. It even sounds radical, right? Uh-huh. And it is. It's deep. It's very deep. You can't maintain race or, in India, caste as separations unless you control in the long term reproduction. So there is a huge backlash against what is a majority opinion in this country that this is an individual human right. It's part of bodily integrity. The government shouldn't intervene. Politicians don't make this decision. But there are people on the other side who firmly believe the contrary, and that this is, and it is in fact, the beginning of the hierarchy they believe in.
How do you see these debates about reproductive freedom and about women's rights being primarily conducted in our body politic by men to begin with?
You know, what they are debating is not so much whether or not there will be abortion, because as the surveys show that 1 in 3 American women had needed an abortion before it was legal and after it had become safe and legal. The difference is the punishment, the huge punishment. I mean, women lost their health, their ability to have children, their lives. But it is about authority. It is about control. So the question is, who controls a woman's body? Herself, which seems to me a requisite of, it's a basic human right. It's a requisite of democracy. But without controlling reproduction, you lose control of nationalism, which has two pillars, which is territory and population. You lose the ability to decide how many workers, how many soldiers, have what class, what race, and so on. It's deep. It hasn't always been true, however. It's important to remember that it's on this subcontinent only the last 500 years. Before that, there were societies in which women controlled their own fertility and controlled agriculture, and men could. I mean, you know, a lot of the languages, like Cherokee, didn't even have he and she. You know, they didn't have a word for race. They didn't have a word for nature, because we were part of nature. I say that because I think it's helpful to realize that we are not dealing with human nature here. We are dealing with a political system.
Mm. You argue in the text that one of the greatest determinants of our lives, Gloria, is whether or not we see the world as welcoming or whether or not we see the world as hostile, because either way, mm-hmm. it becomes a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy. So I ask, how have you seen the world? Has that view changed? Has it been welcoming for the most part or hostile to Gloria Steinem?
I hope I'm realistic about the hostility, but I do see the world potentially and often actually as basically friendly. And maybe, you know, I owe that to my parents who loved me and I was taken care of. I don't know whether it's inherited or not. They say shyness is inherited, for instance. So perhaps a kind of basic the world is friendly or unfriendly is inherited. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But it is very important, I think, to understand that if you don't have hope, you don't act. So it can become a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Mm. So that to the extent that there are women who have legitimately or illegitimately anger that's built up inside of them, what say you, and you talk about this in the book as well, about what women ought to do, how women ought to deal with anger?
Well, you know, I'm not here to say ought, but I'm here to say, you know, based on my mother's life and so much observation, that part of the reason that depression is so very much more culturally a female problem than a male problem, though it's a problem for some men too, mm-hmm. but it's way more a female problem, is because depression is anger turned inward. You know, when you can't express anger, it's viewed as unfeminine or wrong. And the same is true racially. You know, the angry black man, the mm-hmm. angry black woman, that's a cultural prohibition against righteous anger. Mm. I mean, people have a right to be angry. When their rights are trampled on, or when there's violence, but when you're prevented by culture or by danger from expressing that anger, then gradually you get depressed. You feel nothing you do matters.
By my count, 2 or 3 times now in this conversation, Gloria, you've mentioned your parents. I've said many times, and I believe that we are who we are because somebody loved us. We are who we are because somebody loved us, and you've made that point already. people know you, but they don't know your mom and your daddy. They don't know your parents. Tell me about your parents.
Well, my mother had been, and I only discovered this later when I was a teenager, but my mother had been, before I was born, a pioneering newspaper reporter and even an editor at a time when she had to write under a man's name in the beginning in order to get published at all. So it must have been a huge accomplishment. And she loved it. She loved it. She had my sister, who was 9 years older, and by the time my sister was about six. My mother had, I don't know, I wasn't there, but it had such a hard time holding it all together. I mean, my father was a wonderful man, but he was Mr. Irresponsible in the money department. He always had a dream, and I think my mother just, and she had come from a very working class family. He came from a middle class family. Her family was Christian. His was Jewish. I don't know what all the stresses were, but she had had what was then called a nervous breakdown and been in a sanatorium for a couple of years. So by the time I knew her, she had given up her dreams. She was a wonderfully intelligent, smart, loving woman, but she had given up her dreams. My father was a gypsy and had lots of impractical dreams, and we lived in a house trailer until I was 10 most of the time because he had a little summer resort in Michigan, and then we would, with never enough money to make it to where we were going, but get in a trailer and kind of buy and sell little antique items that he had got at auction till we worked our way to Florida or California. So I didn't go to school a full year, I don't think, until I was 11 or something like that. I mean, it would go till it got cold. And So, you know, I mean, I had the most important thing, as you point out, which is that I knew my parents loved me. It was insecure. I wanted to be like other kids. You know, there were other kinds of problems, but the fundamental things were there.
How did you process, in your own words, seeing your mother give up on her dreams? How did you process that in terms of how you would navigate the world?
You know, I'm afraid that in the beginning of my life, until the women's movement came along to make me look at the politics of life itself, you know, of our parents, I was saying, I'm not going to be anything like my mother, a very familiar phrase, which was blaming her for what was not her fault, but a cultural fate. And it really took my empathy with lots of other women before I came back to look at my mother's life. I think it was just too painful to admit that my life, that I could have become like her because she really had given up everything she loved. And now I see it, I can finally see the loss it was to the world and to her. And I think like many, many of us whose parents couldn't do what they wanted, we are living out their unlived life. I don't know if this is true in your life, but I think it's true for a lot of us. And I, you know, we're trying to make a world in which everybody can live out their talents and dreams so children don't feel that they have to do that. It's noble. I'm not complaining. I'm doing what I love. But still, each person should be able to live out his or her dream.
I think you're right about that. And I want to, in the time I have, ask you some specific questions about some contemporary issues. I think that impact that very notion of whether or not we're ever going to be in America where people do, in fact, get a chance to live out their dreams and their best aspirations. Before I ask you about some political and contemporary issues, Gloria, let me start by asking you to tell the story that you tell so beautifully in the book about the most important political lesson that you ever learned. You learned it early on. You learned it in college. And the bottom line is, and I'll let you tell the story, the bottom line is always ask the turtle. Always ask the turtle. So you tell the story, Ms. Steinem.
Yes, it took me a while to realize how important this story was. I was in my first year in college in a geology class going to look at the Connecticut River Valley with a geology professor who was explaining, you know, all the features of the valley while I, of course, was paying no attention because I had walked up a country road, a dirt road, and found a gigantic, huge, snapping mud turtle in the mud on the side of an asphalt road. So I was sure that this turtle was going to crawl up there and get crushed by a car. So I picked up this enormous snapping turtle and with some difficulty got it back down the dirt road, slipped it into the river, and just as it was swimming away, my professor came up behind me and said, you know, that turtle has probably spent a month crawling up that road to lay its eggs in the mud on the side of the asphalt road. I mean, needless to say, I felt terrible. I mean, I was devastated by it. But I have to say, it took a lot of time and living in India and seeing that, learning there that all organizing had to start on the ground and that people know the solution to their own problems and so on, before it dawned on me that I had learned this huge lesson called always ask the turtle.
Mm. What have you learned in your travels then on the heels of that story about being a generous listener?
Well, I've learned that there's a kind of a basic organic rule, which is that if you're in a situation in which, for whatever reason, you're kind of have more power than the other folks, it's important to listen as much as you talk. Mm. And if you have less power than the people you're with, it's important to talk as much as you listen, which is sometimes almost as difficult. If you achieve that balance day by day, it's transforming in itself.
What's the trick to achieving that balance?
Just remembering it, I think, you know, because people with a little more power get used to talking more. And people without power get used to just listening and judging and hiding and not talking and not risking, you know, so it's deep, I find. And I think we all worry about the long term, and we all worry about what we should do, politically speaking, for instance. And if we just say to ourselves, okay, if I do the best I can to create what the goal I want in the short term, I'll get it in the long term. And if I do just daily, it will, if I balance the power in the room and continue to do that, it will lead to a better power balance outside the room. Mm.
The Supreme Court is going to hear another one of these affirmative action cases, and this ruling might not be to the liking of those of us in the progressive community. But the question specifically is, where ought white women specifically be on this issue of affirmative action, since every study, poll, data indicates that white women are doing quite well, benefiting quite well because of this corrective program? Where ought white women's voices be saying about affirmative action?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I and every women's group I know, and, you know, all races of women and men of color have always supported affirmative action and marched for it. I mean, it's ridiculous to suppose, first of all, that long-term handicaps can be done away with in, you know, a short amount of time. The other truth is that having money is the biggest, you know, affirmative action. I mean, people are still getting into, the sons of the ruling class, so to speak, are still getting into their father's alma maters, and that is the hugest form of affirmative action. No, we must do our best to preserve affirmative action because that's the way, it's only just, and also it's for the good of the overall country because it discovers talent. Mm.
Speaking of white women and speaking of the Supreme Court, there is a white woman who sits on the Supreme Court, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who's coming under more pressure, it seems, to step down on the U.S. Supreme Court. She's been quite good, I think we would all agree, on women's issues in her rulings, in her decisions. What say you about this pressure that's building on her to step aside?
That is so ridiculous. That is so ridiculous because there is no way that President Obama, whose choice I would trust absolutely, could get anybody like Ruth Ginsburg through the Senate Judiciary Committee, the the hearings afterwards. It's just not accurate. And I have just seen her in Washington. We hardly ever see each other since, you know, many years since she was at the ACLU. But it happens that I have just seen her, mm-hmm. and I can. In, you know, her office is Thurgood Marshall's office.
That's correct. That's correct, yeah.
I mean, I so felt that I was standing there in the middle of history. And I can testify that she is absolutely, totally smart. And, you know, anything that I ever did with her, she remembers way better than I do. I mean, we need her there.
Yeah. I want to ask about this debate again that I keep reading about headscarves, women and headscarves, and whether or not you specifically think that the right to wear a headscarf is a manifestation of feminism.
You know, the right to do what you want to do with your body is a manifestation of feminism. The right to your own body. The question is whether women really want to do it or they're being forced by society to do it. And I think that that's something we have to listen to women to find out. We have to increase the power of the individual to make that decision. It should absolutely not be a question for the government.
Yeah, I hear you. My time with you is just about up, and I regret that because I could do this for hours. Let me ask, and readers will determine this for themselves when they read the new book by you, My Life on the Road, but what has been the greatest takeaway for you of being fortunate, being blessed enough to travel around this country and indeed around the globe? What's the big takeaway for you?
Oh, there's so many, but I think the diversity of this country, the unpredictability of this country, the fact that the person on the ground knows the solution, back to the turtle, you know, mm-hmm. knows the solution way better than the person at the top. I devoutly wish that every single politician in this country would have to travel without saying they were running for anything, just travel, you know, for a couple of years as a prerequisite to getting elected. It's and it's not a punishment, it's a gift. It's a gift. Mm-hmm. You learn how incredibly diverse and talented, and you cannot predict by how someone looks or what their name is or what their category is. You cannot predict who that person is. So I would say what I've learned is that each human being is a unique combination of heredity and environment combined in a way that could never happen before and could never mm-hmm. happen again, and also a member of the human race.
Yeah.
You know, the fact that early languages didn't label us by gender or race or, you know, I mean, we had clans, but a lot of the interesting Native American names, first names, came about because they would wait until the child did something characteristic of that unique child to name the child. Mm. So, you know, that's what I've learned, and I've come to cherish it. And I'm grateful to the road, which I never otherwise would have done if I hadn't been unable to publish what I cared about politically and ended up going out on the road. And I'm grateful for that because now I've discovered that what happens when you're physically present with each other can't be replaced.
Yeah. Even though you set me up beautifully talking about politicians traveling on the road trying to get elected, you set me up beautifully. I'm going to pass on the Hillary question because I'm sure in every other conversation you have about this book, you'll be asked about Hillary. So we'll dispense of that question and let the other interviewers ask you about Hillary. I'll just say thank you to Gloria Steinem. Her new text is called My Life on the Road. Ms. Steinem, good to have you on. All the best to you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for this program.
From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. There's been a major shift in U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. The Obama administration, which had previously pledged to draw down America's military presence in the region, now says it will keep nearly 10,000 troops in Afghanistan. The president has also authorized the Pentagon to deploy a small team of elite special operations forces to Syria to aid in the fight against ISIS. Joining us now is Gail Samak-Lemone, senior fellow at the Council on Foreign Relations and author of the new text, Ashley's War, the untold story of a team of women soldiers on the special ops battlefield. Gail, good to have you back on this program.
Great to join you always.
So am I right about a shift on both of these matters?
Well, it depends on who you talk to,
sure.
Right?
The administration,
The administration will say, no, it's not a shift. Yeah. It's a slight change, right? Yeah. But the truth is, it is much harder to end wars than it sounds at the beginning. And also, what we see is the world is getting increasingly dangerous in terms of a metastasizing threat, in terms of ISIS and what's happening in ungoverned spaces. And so I think Iraq and the ghost of the Iraq war looms large over every single foreign policy decision coming. Mm-hmm. And you've seen an administration wrestling, searching for this Goldilocks strategy on military force, right? Not too little, not too much, and it's very hard to find.
Yeah. To those hawks, be they Republican or Democrat, mostly Republican, who look at the president and say, we told you so about Afghanistan, that you weren't going to have much choice in this matter. Yeah. Do they have a point that the president was told about this and went his own way?
I think they do, right? Because the truth is that, you know, the Iraqi foreign minister went to Afghanistan and told then Hamid Karzai, president, sign the bilateral security agreement. Because look at what happened in Iraq when you have a total go to zero of U.S. forces. And I think that plus the Iraq experience plus the ISIS growth has really shown that we may not want to stay in Afghanistan, but it is a whole lot less expensive to stay with 10,000 troops than to bring everybody home and then to send them back.
Mm-hmm. The goalposts keep moving here. So are we going to be in Afghanistan for the foreseeable future, forever? Like, when does this story ever get to the end?
It depends on what your goals are. Right. And I think that is the challenge with both Afghanistan and Syria policy, which is, what are you trying to do? And then you can figure out what the force is that's needed. What's the diplomatic effort that is needed? And I think we haven't seen enough conversation as a country about what it is that we are trying to achieve both with its Syria policy and in Afghanistan. And, you know, if your goal is to keep the Afghan government from falling and to keep the Taliban from overrunning it and ISIS from using ungoverned spaces, then you will be there for a while.
Whether one thinks the president, you know, has to eat crow on this or not, is it the right decision to leave these troops in Afghanistan?
I believe it is. Yeah. And I think that the administration was very honest about, look, we've said facts on the ground. We're going to determine what our pace was. And it looks like we are not ready to leave because the Afghan security forces have taken huge losses. More than 5,000 Afghan troops have died just this year. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's not like they're not fighting, but they are not fully ready because that Taliban threat is, you know, it's basically whack-a-mole right now. Mm-hmm. There were raids in October on Al-Qaeda training camps in southern Afghanistan, right? This whole threat has not gone away. And right now, what we see is that American forces are required, if your goal is to keep Al-Qaeda from coming back and to keep the Afghan government from falling to the Taliban, then you are going to be there.
How heavy a price are we paying year after year after year for this mistake about Iraq?
The Iraq war, I think, is the ghost that looms over every single U.S. foreign policy conversation right now. And if you look at what's happening, some people say, look, it's the fact that we left Iraq the way we did that is what is responsible for the growth of ISIS and all of the creation of these ungoverned spaces, lack of governance that has led to lots of unhappiness within Iraq and to sectarian violence. And look, I mean, this is going to be a conversation that historians have for decades about what this means. The question is now, how does American foreign policy go in and continue to actually make a difference in terms of keeping as few ungoverned spaces as possible and to help people who are on the side of, you know, progress and fighting for a better future for their kids every single day, which is happening in Iraq, in Syria, in Afghanistan. We just never hear those stories.
What kinds of comments then, what kind of commitments, what kind of pledges can we really take seriously from persons running for the White House right now about this Afghanistan situation? I mean, Everybody wants to, they're being asked about it in these debates. Everybody wants to make a statement. How can you believe what anybody says on the campaign trail now?
Well, I mean, this is the thing. I think we have to be honest as a country about the world which our grandchildren will inherit and what kind of American force and what kind of American foreign policy we want to see. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I agree with those who would say the ISIS threat does not remain a limited regional threat for very long, left unchecked, right? And so I think it is an honest conversation that the American public actually has to demand from its leaders, and we have yet to actually see that materialize. But look, in 2011, the president gave a speech, the tide of war is receding. Mm-hmm. You know, no doubt he believed that at the time, but the world has its own way of changing facts on the ground, and America is either going to follow that and exert leadership or it's not.
As we've already, you know, discussed here, we've paid a heavy price, no matter where one comes down on this Iraq invasion, whether it was the right thing or wrong thing to do, we paid a heavy price for that. But we're also paying a heavy price, to your point now, Gail, about the fact that we missed this ISIS or ISIL. Yeah. We missed this. How did we miss it? And how dangerous at the moment is the threat?
So I would argue, I was going back through notes of people I've interviewed for, you know, 2.5 years, 3 years on this. People saw this materializing. It was the speed at which it happened that I think surprised people. But there were huge debates within the administration and a fight about what kind of intervention to do in Syria. And I think don't do stupid stuff sort of became a foreign policy. But not doing any stuff is also a challenge. And I think this administration has really understandably grappled with this, you know, push me, pull you between doing too much and not doing enough. And I think ISIS really took advantage of a lack of governed space. It really went in there and it used it for its own ends to create an entity that now wants to hold territory, which is, I think, part of what is causing such an extreme threat. And I don't think that that threat is going away. I talked to young Afghans who talk about ISIS leaflets being dropped among community activists, you know, and the fear that that's instilling.
The president's explanations or justifications notwithstanding, how much longer will the American public be able to tolerate this Afghanistan situation?
It is such an excellent question. And I honestly wonder myself, because the truth is we have acted like we are not a country at war for years. Officially, combat operations ended in 2014, but I know people who are deployed right now. Mm-hmm. There are people all around this country whose families are deployed right now. Does it feel to them like they're not at war? Of course it doesn't. Mm-hmm. Right? And I don't think as a nation we have asked ourselves what it feels like to be a country at war. Less than 1% of this country has fought 100% of 14 years of war. Mm-hmm. And I think we need as a nation to reckon with that.
Well, the answer to my question is then that it can go on unabated for years to come if people don't feel connected to
That's right. If it never affects your life, if you go to the mall and you go to pick up your kids every day, and it barely pierces your daily life that you are actually a nation at war, then how, you know, I even talk to people on the Hill who say, as long as nobody makes a big deal about it, my member can get behind voting for continued troops. Mm-hmm. The minute it pierces the American public's imagination and attention, well, then, you know, we're not going to get behind that. So it's almost like our leaders are relying on our own, you know, reluctance to take on the fact that what, you know, what is a nation at war.
So to the extent then that the American public does, to your point now, feel disconnected, disabusement of the notion that we'll ever bring troops home.
Right. Well, here's the thing. I mean, I don't think you can have endless war, right, as a country. But I also think that you have to have a goal and a strategy and a conversation with the country about what is required if you're trying to keep America secure and safe and what the nature of evolving threats facing the United States.
But that's my point, though. My point is, I hear your point that you don't think we can have endless war, but I think you can, in theory, have endless war if the American people are disconnected from what's happening in Afghanistan.
Well, and also disconnected from what's happening with their own forces who are serving in Afghanistan, right? And that's the challenge, right, is that people have been asked so little, you know, about what is actually required of them. Nobody that, you know, maybe what, 5%, 10% of people you know feel a daily connection to what's happening in this conflict. So 10,000 troops becomes this abstract notion, this abstract number, until Master Sergeant Josh Wheeler gets killed in Iraq, right? And we have our first casualty where we see a family that's actually affected by the loss of their loved one doing its country's bidding.
So if the optics on this Afghanistan thing are wrong, the optics on this Syria thing are really bad, John Kerry sitting in a meeting, he's sitting in a meeting trying to figure out a solution to the crisis, and the White House announces that we're sending troops. I mean, it's only 50 people, 50 special ops, but still, you said you weren't going to put boots on the ground. You are putting boots on the ground, and you announced that while Kerry's in a meeting trying to work this situation out. What do you make of that?
Look, it is not an easy time to be talking about American foreign policy if you are a public figure, right? Yeah. Because, you know, then they have to go through this whole conversation, which is technically accurate. They're not combat troops, but they are special operations forces going into a combat theater in a region that is full of combat in every single direction. So while their mission might not specifically be a combat mission, there's no question they'll be in a combat theater facing combat threats. So, you know, you get yourself into a spaghetti of a conversation, right, about U.S. foreign policy instead of saying, look, the truth is that we're trying to do some limited things. One is helping the Kurds to fight ISIS in the north, because U.S. foreign policy is now not Assad must go, which officially it still is, but in reality, Assad is kind of staying, right? And so the next strategy is, okay, help the moderate forces in some ways, help the Kurds fight ISIS, get everybody back to the table, convince the Russians that we are not going to give up and they can't kill every moderate that is opposing Assad, and eventually we might have a peaceful transition. In the meantime, the World Food Program requires $25 million every week just to feed people affected by the Syrian conflict. The human toll of this war is just devastating.
Are we, the U.S. of A., doing enough or doing too much?
On the humanitarian side, I think the Americans are doing a great deal, right? Absolutely. On the military intervention side, it depends on who you talk to, right? Because there has always been, you talk to Ambassador Ross, you talk to a lot of folks who you have regularly on these programs, right? A number of military leaders, and they'll say, look, the cost of inaction in Syria was never fully assessed. Right. And I do think that there is a very understandable desire to stay out of all of wars, particularly in Syria, where there is and never was a great option for the United States. But the cost of inaction, you know, in 2011, 2012, I think it's part of what we're paying now.
Guantanamo.
Yeah.
He has two choices. Either you leave Guantanamo open, and if you leave it open, as you leave office, you have, you know, not fulfilled a campaign pledge that you made to close Guantanamo. So do you leave office with an unfulfilled campaign pledge, or do you close it, and you do that by pushing back on Congress, pushing back on Congress, and quite frankly, expanding presidential powers? Right. What do you care about more, the expansion of presidential powers or keeping a campaign commitment? What does he come down on this ultimately?
Well, and where's national security in that, right?
Yeah.
And legacy, which are two factors that I think very much play into this conversation, right? If you close Guantanamo and something happens, right, God forbid, for all of our sakes, that is something that I'm sure keeps the White House up every single night as you have this, because there's no doubt they want to close Guantanamo. But it, again, like ending wars, it is much easier said in a campaign promise or at a podium than it is with the messy facts of real life on the ground.
Well, I enjoy having you on. Appreciate your insights, Kayle.
Thank you. Great to
have you here. From PRI, Public Radio International in Los Angeles, I'm Tavis Smiley. The city of Detroit has in recent years been associated with negative depictions of abandoned businesses, blighted neighborhoods, and corrupt politicians. Best-selling author and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David Marinus counters that image with a new book that covers 18 months in the life of Detroit, from the fall of 1962 to the spring of 1964. That brief window of time is rich with so much history, a booming automobile era, and pivotal moments in music, labor, and civil rights, events that have helped define not just the city of Detroit, but indeed the entire nation. The book is titled Once in a Great City, A Detroit Story. David, good to have you back on this program.
Thank you, Tavis.
I want to go right to the beginning of the text, and you say, as I just intimated, that the story of Detroit was not just about the life and times of one city, the automobile, music, labor, civil rights, the middle class. So much of what defines our society and culture can be traced to Detroit, either made there or tested there or strengthened there. So this is more than just a Detroit story.
Well, that's why I wanted to write the book.
Yeah.
You know, I was born in Detroit. There were a lot of reasons for having an emotional and strong effect on me. But so much of what we've heard about Detroit over the last few decades has been the city of ruin. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to remind people and honor this city for all that it gave this country. As you said, you know, yeah. not just cars and the soundtrack of my generation, yeah. Motown, yeah. But also labor, you know, with the United Auto Workers as the heart of the labor movement, mm-hmm. the progressive labor movement, and civil rights in so many ways. So many things happened in Detroit.
What made this year, we're really talking 1963,
yeah.
what made this year so rich in history?
Well, I focused on that year. My sort of metaphor for how I research is set my oil rig somewhere and dig down as deep as I can. Mm-hmm. And I knew I wanted to deal with those four subjects, cars, Motown, labor, and civil rights. Mm-hmm. So one of the first things I discovered was that in the same week, the Detroit Auto Show introduced the 63 models that would sell more than ever before, mm-hmm. and that the Mustang was secretly being conceived then, the car of the 60s sure. in a way. The same week, the first Motortown Review left West Grand Boulevard taking that music to the country. And so that sort of got me there. And mm-hmm. then the center pole of the book, I realized, was when Martin Luther King came to Detroit and the largest civil rights rally mm-hmm. to that point in American history was held in Detroit, you know, not in Washington. Mm-hmm. So that sort of took me there, that I could see that all of the elements that I wanted to write about were at their strength right then.
And what did you see when you got there?
Well, when I first got to Detroit to do the research, mm-hmm. This was 4 years ago, and I say sort of jokingly, but it's sadly almost true, that I was staying at a bed and breakfast near the Detroit Institute of Arts mm-hmm. and would walk over to the Walter Reuther Library two blocks away. You have to cross Woodward Avenue, the main thoroughfare of the city, to get there. And I felt I could stop in the middle of the street and read War and Peace and not get hit by a car. Mm-hmm. You know, it just felt mm-hmm. that desolate. I've gone back 10 times since then, you know, for a lot of research, and then as the book came out. And every time I felt more energy. So I think, you know, I'm a journalist. I want to be skeptical but optimistic about life. Mm-hmm. But I think that this is a real revival coming in Detroit now. It's starting to move from that symbol of a city of ruin to a city of hope again. Yeah.
What happened from its crescendo of 63 that brought...
Well, you know, the interesting thing to me was that you could see it even then. I mm-hmm. described Detroit at that era as an incandescent star that was a dying star. Mm-hmm. So that sociologists at Wayne State University in 1963...
predicted this.
Yes, said that Detroit mm-hmm. was losing 500,000 people per decade. The tax base was shrinking that dramatically, and that would continue for the foreseeable future, creating all these problems. Now, this is before the riots of 1967, mm-hmm. before the city pensions that many people or some people blame Detroit's demise on. Mm-hmm. It's before the era of corrupt mayors. Before all of that, there were structural problems, mm-hmm. some common to a lot of cities, some particular to Detroit, especially that it was a one-industry town, essentially. And the auto industry was moving out of Detroit, had been for several years by then, mm-hmm. Both physically and emotionally, sort of turning its back on this great city that created it.
Yeah. How did race factor into your research? What did you see about race in your research?
Well, race was everywhere. I mean, mm-hmm. I consider race the American dilemma everywhere, and Detroit is symbolic of that. Here you have a city that had a long history of racial tensions. In World War II, one of the largest race riots in American history occurred in Detroit. It was basically a struggle between blacks coming up in the Great Migration for jobs in the city and Appalachian whites also, and they're competing mm-hmm. over housing and jobs, and a racist police force over the years sort of inciting more difficulties in the city. So that by 1963, you had what seemed to be an era of hope even there. The new mayor, Jerome Kavanaugh, was elected largely by the African-American vote. He brought in a progressive police chief, George Edwards, who said he only came to try to help race relations in the city. They certainly were supportive of the civil rights movement. There's a great scene where George Edwards, the police commissioner, greets Martin Luther King at the airport when he arrives
and says, no dogs,
got a lot of weight to it, you know, when you think about what happened to King and the protesters in Birmingham only a few months earlier. So all of that was there, but yet a month after this event, there's a shooting of a African-American prostitute, And it's sort of a precursor of Ferguson, you know, and all of those sort of feelings start bubbling up again.
Yeah. You can't write a great book, as you've done any number of times, many great books, but you can't write a great book without great characters. And this book has some characters in it. First of all, the city of Detroit is itself a character in your story.
Right.
But there's some great characters. I'm going to throw a few names at you.
Sure.
You can just talk, you can tell me about them in no particular order, since you already mentioned Walter Reuther. Walter Reuther.
I think he's one of the great underappreciated figures in 20th century social history. The head of the United Auto Workers, very prescient in many ways. He foresaw both the effects that technology would have on his industry and the problem with Detroit making all these big cars, expensive cars. In the book, he's trying to persuade the big three automakers to build more compact cars and less expensive cars. But beyond that, he was a progressive in ways that probably were ahead of his rank and file. Mm-hmm. You know, many of those auto workers in later years moved out to the suburbs and voted for George Wallace. Mm-hmm. Reuther was a very strong supporter of civil rights. You could say, in a sense, that the United Auto Workers was the bank for the civil rights movement that summer of 63. They're the ones who sent the money down to Birmingham to get King's supporters out of jail. They supported, to a great degree, the March on Washington a few months later. So Reuther had profound effects, both in terms of the industry and in American civil rights history.
You mentioned Kavanaugh, the mayor, so we've talked about him a little bit already.
Yeah.
Let me jump then to, we all know Aretha Franklin, but most of us don't know her daddy, the Reverend C.L. Franklin.
Yeah. Yeah, no, what a character he was.
Yeah.
You know, New Bethel Baptist Church, the most popular church in Detroit, the church of the streets, you might say. Mm-hmm. He would fill it up. You know, there'd be people listening on loudspeakers outside of the church. In previous years, he'd been sort of a flying circuit preacher. He'd take his sermons to the South, to arenas, and fill them up. Mm-hmm. Of course, he had his three daughters with him, which didn't hurt listening to Aretha. His sermons were so popular that they were recorded by Chess Records. Mm-hmm. You could hear them on the radio. And he would say that it was almost like being a rock star. He'd go to some arena and people would shout out, you know, let's hear the eagle stirreth its nest, you know. He was not particularly beloved by the establishment black ministerial alliance in Detroit, Baptist ministry. They thought he was too flamboyant, which he was, for their taste. Mm-hmm. So there was some reluctance to have him be the focal point of the Walk to Freedom, the great rally in Detroit. He pulled it off. 150,000 people walked down the streets of Detroit to Cobo Arena, where King gave the first iteration in a large public setting of his I Have a Dream speech. Mm-hmm. Now, one person said to me later, you know, it's lucky that Reverend Franklin didn't preach before King, because it would have overshadowed anything that King
said. As you know, they were very dear friends, and the way that Aretha got to know Dr. King so well, as you know, is that whenever King was in Detroit, he would stay at the Franklin home.
Yes.
So Aretha grew up cooking breakfast with Dr. King and hanging out with him as a child. That's how you
got it. It's kind of amazing. And, you know, when you think of all those great figures in Detroit then, I mean, also as a child, Smokey Robinson would come over and play with Aretha's brother.
That's right.
You know? I mean, what incredible talent came out of
Detroit. Which leads to Berry Gordy, another character in your book.
Yeah, I try to give credit not only to Berry Gordy, but to his whole family, the Gordy family, a very strong entrepreneurial family. He had four older sisters who were essential to Motown as well.
That's right.
Created Motown out of an $800 loan that he got from that family. Gordy had a specific genius, which was finding talent and knowing what to do with it. You wonder why it happened in Detroit. Gordy's one of the reasons. Why this creative burst? Why does it happen in certain civilizations, certain cities at certain times? Gordy and his family, a key part of that. He started in the assembly line, so connecting cars and music. And he really started writing songs then. But he, you know, to bring together Smokey Robinson, Mary Wells, the Four Tops, the Temptations, the Supremes, you know, Martha and the Vandellas, Marvin Gaye, and Stevie Wonder.
Yeah.
What an incredible collection he brought.
You wrote another book, another bestseller called When Pride Still Mattered. I wonder whether or not all these years later, after 1963, you think in Detroit the pride still matters.
It sure does.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's been beaten down, but there's a lot of grit in Detroit, and the people there are proud. You know, it went through a period where a lot of people left. The country turned its back on Detroit, blamed Detroit for its own problems. Certainly, you can blame certain aspects of it on that, but But the pride remained.
Are there quick lessons that other cities, and there is no city quite like Detroit,
yeah.
But are there one or two lessons you think the other cities ought to pay attention to it to not end up like Detroit?
Well, you know, if we had those answers, it'd be a magical yeah. world. But I think that the key one is think about the long term,
yeah.
not the short term.
Right.
You know, you're leaving Detroit for the short term, but in the end, you need Detroit.
Yeah.
That's true of the auto industry in particular.
Sure.
There are a lot of cities, whether it's the Silicon Valley or other cities, that depend too much on one industry. And you've got to keep at it. You've got to keep working on those places that are heart and soul of America, and I think cities like Detroit are.
Yeah. David's a great writer. Of course, you know that. His latest is called Once in a Great City, a Detroit story, as only he could tell it. David, congratulations on the book, and thanks for doing it, man.
Thank you,
Dennis. Good to have you.
I always love being with you.
Glad to have you back, my friend. You can catch me weeknights on my television show on PBS. For more info on what I'm doing or to hear this show, past shows, or the Tavis Smiley Show podcast, visit TavisSmileyRadio.com. Tavis Smiley Show is a news and opinion program produced and recorded in Los Angeles by SRP Productions in partnership with Public Radio International. Tony Marcano is our executive producer. I'm Tavis Smiley. This is PRI. Keep the faith.